in some sense, what I'm going to do is illustrate what we just heard in the sermon. And because he covered many of these things, perhaps we can go over them a little more quickly. Some of this is a redux from last night, hoping that I can make some connection. I believe that that my pastor, who just spoke to us tonight, has also said of the church that its two main tasks, or two of the main tasks of the church, is worship and witness. That is what we do as a local church. And in the last two presentations that I'm going to look at, we're going to look at both of those things. First of all, tonight, worship, and then tomorrow, witness. Worship being, of course, the centerpiece of this conference, the architectural setting of Christian worship. This is more of the internal side. And tomorrow, I hope to look at the external witness of the church as we look at architecture in relation to urban design. Well, just to review things that we know so well now and probably knew even before coming here. The church, the ecclesia, is the called out body that worships the true and living God and worships according to Scripture, sola scriptura, using the elements of Christian worship, which are word, sacraments, and prayer, as we've heard eloquently this evening, and congregational singing, we might add. So what we want to look at is how have churches throughout history served these purposes, specifically in the liturgical setting. And we'll make a broad and broad sweep history. Once again, another run through through church history, which we'll do once again very quickly. I should say, when you think about building churches, of course, as we do, that church building buildings, plural, do other things than serve public worship services. We have counseling, we have pastors who need study time and libraries, we have Sunday schools, youth programs, choir practice, other needs that make church architecture more complicated in many ways today than before. But we're not going to address those things, maybe a little bit tomorrow. Our question is, how has architecture served the activities and forms of Christian worship? And we remember things that we've already looked at. For example, in the Domus Ecclesiae, we see that that the forms that worship takes were served by an arrangement of spaces, by a separation of spaces. And we'll be tracking these two ideas, right? There are the spaces, the places for worship, which are delineated in buildings, and then there are the furnishings that attend these. Well, we see here right away a kind of segregation taking place, as we've noticed. We've got the atrium, a gathering place, which is literally perhaps where the word comes from, because the atrium was the gathering point of a Greco-Roman house. And then we have the various rooms, the baptistry, the room for the Lord's Supper, the agape meal, and then the gathering room for the preaching of the word. And then we saw in the Basilica a slightly different arrangement. I have mentioned, and Dr. Old has mentioned this too, the presence of the atrium, which is quite common in early Christian basilicas. So at Old St. Peter's, we had the gateway, the atrium, the narthex, and then the Basilica. It's a longitudinal building, as we had said before, and this serves some of what we know happened in churches such as this. That is, the longitudinal axis suggests procession. It suggests entry. And we know that elaborate entry processions, as still are part of Christian worship in certain traditions, are part of the directionality of the worship. We also know that there was some segregation going on. That's the atrium was a gathering point. It was also the point at which the neophytes who had not been baptized yet would go no further than. There was a separation, unbaptized but confessing or desiring to join the church members would be in the atrium, and then upon baptism be able to move into the narthex. Even there, we know that there was some segregation that took place in St. Peter's and others, where the laity would be in the aisles. And at some point in the early Christian period, they would be separated not just by being put in the aisles, but curtains or some kind of barrier would be erected between the aisles and the nave. So the nave becomes increasingly the place for the procession and the place for the priesthood, and in an imperial church such as this, for the emperor in his entry. We also know that, as we mentioned, that the transept here was perhaps conceived because this is where the burials were. There was more than just Peter that was buried here, and this was a set-apart space. And, of course, we know that Peter was buried there, and it was just beyond that that the altar was placed significantly in front of the apse and covered by a ciborium or a baldacchino to suggest its importance. These elements we find developing in the early Christian period, and we have some evidences of these in early Christian basilicas. Here's Santa Sabina and Santa Maria Maggiore, two 5th century basilicas, now quite empty. We see the longitudinal space, but we can imagine that there was more in here then when they were being used, and certainly there is today. You will notice some separation here at Santa Sabina, a barrier of sorts, which constitutes the chancel. The chancel, from a word that would refer to a fence, that separates a space that then comes to be called the chancel. We also notice the covered altar at Santa Maria Maggiore, although it's a Baroque covering. It is in keeping with the early Christian practice. Here's a diagram of other features that develop in the early Christian period. A solea, a fence surrounding an area reserved for the priests, allowed the priests to move out to, although it's not shown here, a raised platform for reading and another one for preaching, an ambo. Behind that, we have the altar, which is not against the wall at this time, and the earliest altars were wooden tables, not stone altars. This will change. And behind that, we have a throne for the bishop. It's a bishop's church, a cathedral, and more seating in a synthronon, or also known as a presbyterion, similar to the Presbyterian practice, where presbyters would be seated facing the congregation. We have a good example of a multi-tiered presbyterion or synthronon at the Romanesque church in Torcello near Venice. Here's an example of a church. It's called San Clemente. It's actually a later church with an earlier arrangement of furnishings that shows the solea and two ambos, a bima, that's the raised platform in the back, and an altar with a covering, a ciborium. Well, these are some of the features that we know were there, and of course we can read, and Dr. Old and others of you theologians have done more reading than I about the liturgies that attended such things. Now, in the Eastern tradition, some of the same features are there. We know that most of the features I just mentioned would have been in place at Hagia Sophia in the time of Justinian, who built this this great church, which, of course, is both centrally and longitudinally arranged. We also know that that the entry procession, and especially because it was the emperor's church, the procession which included the emperor amongst the priesthood, showing his sacred place in the society, was at the center of the Christian worship that that took place here. Very elaborate rituals, as I referred to in the description before. The preaching, though, would have been from an ambo, which would be more or less in the center, according to the descriptions that that we know, although separated. There'd be great separation here of various levels of society, some of whom would be in the gallery above, some in the side aisles, and the most privileged people closest to the center. Byzantine churches follow this centralized pattern, and they follow Hagia Sophia in many ways, except for San Vitale, which predates it. I show you here several plans that suggest how the Byzantine tradition developed. And another thing that we know is that in time after Justinian, because of the central plan, even the liturgy, even the processions, began also to have circular movements as well throughout the seder and the naos or the nave. In the Middle Byzantine period, that is the 11th and 10th centuries, Byzantine churches tend to become smaller. They become smaller perhaps because they are no longer actually welcome to worshipers at all. The worshipers remain in the atrium or in the narthex, and they listen, they attend, they hope, and they are there knowing that great mysteries are taking place inside the treasured room of the church. So we have these tiny jewel-like churches, such as the Catholicon at the monastery of Hosius Lucas in Greece, one of the best preserved of these. And these churches are amazing cruciform structures with domes at the top, all covered with mosaics and sometimes paintings. And even that very sacred space is not sacred enough because the sacrament occurs behind screen wall, known as the iconostasis, where the elevation takes place and where the mystery of the Mass occurs. Here's looking up at the iconographic program, which shows Christ as judge of all the world, the Pantocrator, who gazes down upon the mysteries of the rituals of the Byzantine Church. Now, that's just to give you some sense of what we are not in the Reformed tradition. Also to show some connection. Many of these elements were shared both in East and West. Several things that we could point out, and this is going to be somewhat hit and miss as we look at developments, not necessarily in perfect chronology, in Western architecture in the Middle Ages. I'm showing here a plan of a basilica never built, a hypothetical plan of a monastic church that dates to the 9th century, 816 or 820. Suppose it's a double apsed basilica that's absolutely enormous in size and has a very high chancel area where the bima would have been, and a crypt now placed underneath where burials could take place and where relics might be kept. What's also interesting in this 9th century plan is the multiplicity of altars. Every one of these crosses is an altar, and we have proliferation of altars taking place as early as the 6th century, we know, and I skipped over this. We also know that the wooden tables by the 6th century are becoming stone tables, and they are representing various things. Some of the reasoning for this is that the sacrifice is based on Christ alone, who is our rock, and so the rock becomes the material to be used for the table. But the associations, once relics start coming into churches, which is really quite early, and being placed in some cases underneath the table, they become associated with tombs, and there's a conflation of these ideas. So the altar is a place of death and resurrection, and it also builds upon the saints who've gone before. So the inclusion of relics and burials is another theme that we see as the church develops in its furnishing. Other developments that we see are complications in the plan. The original Basilican plan, as we see, it mutates somewhat. It grows. We have here in a Romanesque pilgrimage church, we have a small narthex. We have twin towers established. The nave becomes relatively narrow, and we have now two side aisles, so a five-aisle basilica, like St. Peter's. In this case, at Saint-Sernin in Toulouse, it becomes clear that the outer aisle allows the pilgrim visiting on their way to Santiago de Compostela, for example, to go into this church and tour, have a look at it, to observe some of the relics which are contained in altars in side chapels, and yet not themselves transgress the sanctuary, which may or may not be in use. That is, you can walk all the way around in this space, including in the area known as the ambulatory, with its side chapels that creates this rather sculptural-like effect, both on the outside and the inside. You'll notice, too, that the area, the apse, is growing. It's growing longer. This area, known as the chancel for the screen wall that was once there, is becoming the reserve of the clergy. This is the set-apart sanctuary. So the part that's for ordinary people would be the nave, and in this case, the ambulatory. Similar sorts of things happen in Gothic churches, such as at Chartres. We still have the ambulatory, and we have a chancel that continues to grow in its size. The English were the best at growing this section of the church, so that the typical English cathedral, which operated both as a cathedral and a monastic church, with a full complement of monks who would sing the services, they occupied at least half, sometimes two-thirds of the church belonged to the clergy, and the public, the laity, would have the nave and the transepts for their use, but never proceed beyond this. It would be blocked by screens and by the choir furnishings, which Terry had alluded to, choir here sitting in the center, with two transepts, each holding special altars where masses could be said, now also private masses being said on behalf of families who built their own private chapels. A similar kind of arrangement is in the parish church at St. Alphage from the 16th century that enumerates some of these features. The separation that we've talked about begins with the chancel screen, but we find by the Gothic period it's quite common to separate through a screen that would entirely block our view of the mysteries that are taking place in the sacrament. Here is an example, also from Torcello, as I showed you before, of a screen. The English would refer to this as a rood screen, the rood being a word referring to the cross, which was the first excuse. It's cut off here, but the beam here holds the cross, which then becomes connected in many churches with the screen, which then becomes a place for decoration. These were largely dismantled and taken out of continental European churches in the Renaissance, and especially after Trent, when there was a desire to reconnect visually. But you can still find them if you go to Spain, where the tradition, where for some reason they don't seem to have been dismantled. And in fact, in cases such as you see here in Toledo, redesigned, embellished even in the Renaissance, disconcerting to Americans wanting to look down the aisle and see that great vista, it's blocked by a screen and then by a choir and all this stuff that gets in the way. The French occasionally retain this practice too, which they call the jubé, and there's a really wonderful 16th century one with this great spiral stairs on either side that you can see in Saint-Étienne. And of course the English did not cease to use, they had a reformation come around the same time, which ordered the screens to be dismantled, but then, of course, because of complications under Archbishop Laud, they're brought back, and they're taken away again, and they're brought back in the Restoration, and then there some remain, and then they become popular once again under the Oxford movement, the ecclesiological movement that we've referred to. Here is one that comes from pre-Reformation, and in many parish churches, this is what you would see if you're standing in the nave of the church. You wouldn't see anything more. If you wanted to see the Mass being said, you would go up close and look for holes which were actually placed in there so you could get a glimpse of the host, of the bread, when it was raised and consecrated by the priest. The decorations that you see on the screens are part of the tendency in churches throughout the Middle Ages to be decorated, as you've already noticed, by mosaics in some cases, by screens, and by altarpieces. The mainstay of art history is the study of these altarpieces. They become most popular, actually, in the late Middle Ages, in churches that typically were not screened, and even more so in the Renaissance, when many of the screens come down. Ironically, here I'm showing you a Protestant altarpiece from Wittenberg, painted by Lucas Cranach. This is in the Lutheran tradition, where an altarpiece is not a bad thing for them. Of course, having pictures in churches was a debate even in the Middle Ages. Many of you know that it was Gregory the Great who made the strongest case for this, and declared from his office that paintings and narrative works are useful because they teach those who cannot read words, and especially those barbarians, as he said, who would otherwise not have the gospel if they had not these pictures. Bibles for the poor, they referred to the churches being complete with a kind of Sunday school room of pictures. Now, we've referred to this, and Dr. Old has mentioned, right, there's a revival of preaching that takes place in the 12th century under Bernard, and especially under preaching orders, the mendicant orders. And I've shown Santa Croce before, this vast hall. And, of course, with the revival of preaching comes the revival of a pulpit, the word that now supplants ambo for the place of the preaching of the word. And there's a great big one here halfway down the aisle in Santa Croce where people would gather to hear Franciscan preachers, or Dominican churches would have such a thing as well. And it's probably this idea that leads to some of the reforms, as I said yesterday, to Renaissance architecture. San Lorenzo from the 15th century also has a significantly sized pulpit a little further down. And it's free of screens. We can see the space. And there is, as we said, a revival of early Christian form. What complicates our view of the architectural setting of Christian worship in the Renaissance is this fascination with the central plan that most historians have said is a fascination of the architect. Architects coming to churches and to popes and saying, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could make a church which is a representation of the cosmos that is perfect in every way, circular or almost circular. And we find drawings by Leonardo, for example, imagining what circular churches would be, or Bramante's church. And of course, it was quite legitimate for a martyrial church, that is a small chapel not used for the gathering of people, but to say Mass and to celebrate the death of Peter, to build a building like this. And so we have quite a number of these, but when architects went to important churches, take St. Peter's, for example, and said, let's do this, Pope Julius II, under whom this was designed, said yes, but subsequent popes said, no way, we're not going to have a circular church. How can you have the great processions that we had? It doesn't work according to the liturgy. And so very few at really centralized planned churches are made. They're thought about, they're dreamed about, and the ones that we have tend to be martyrial churches or pilgrimage churches such as San Biagio, which marks the spot of the apparition of the Virgin Mary, a magnificent church, perhaps also designed by Bramante, perhaps looking, appearing the way that St. Peter's might have appeared had it been built the way that Bramante had intended. Now, what's further interesting to me about this fascination with the central plan is that the reformers will have a similar fascination, probably not for the same reasons that Bramante and others had, as we'll see. So let's skip then to the reformers and think about what they wanted. In fact, you don't have to think about it. You were just heard the sermon that explained it better than I could ever do. The reformers were critical of many of the practices, the use of images, the inclusion of relics the use of multiple altars, the use of altars at all, and so these things were expunged. They were taken out, and occasionally they were taken out in rather severe and sometimes even violent ways. But more normally, it was done with good order, and renovations had to be made. We no longer have pictures. We no longer have screens, because we are all priests under Christ. And so we gather now. We gather to hear the word, to celebrate the sacraments, and to pray. So how was that done in an existing church? I've showed you some pictures before. Here are some diagrams from André Dulier's book, great little book that describes a quick survey of Christian worship from a Reformed standpoint. And he shows us churches, for example, such as the cathedral at Geneva. There's a good one. Right here is the Geneva Cathedral. It's a basilica with a transept, with a chancel and an apse and a choir, which would have blocked our view, and a high altar in the center, another altar back there. Apparently, all of this stuff was taken out, and in its place, seating was placed, fixed seating. In fact, the evidence suggests not only was it fixed, but it was tiered so that those behind, like a theater, could see above the heads of others and focused on the preaching of the word at the corner here. So there's this gathered church, and you'll notice that half the church is not used. We don't know if it wasn't used, but that's the evidence, and I haven't studied specifically what the evidence is for this. It's not quite that way today. But we have this turn into a gathered church around the preaching of the word, very evidently. Similar things happen in these other examples at Basel, the three Basel churches that are shown here. You can see that there's a kind of experimental phase going on. How can we rearrange the furniture to make it fit the auditory purposes of the preached word? Our pictures help us too. If we go to Holland and we look at the Sonradon pictures, we can see Simbavo, we see the inclusion of a large pulpit at the apse end in this case, but it wasn't always the same way. For example, at St. Adolphus Church, we recognize a basilica with side aisles and a nave and a preacher preaching to what is kind of an installed wooden church layout with furnishings, with benches, with fixed seating. And, of course, the orientation has been changed now. No longer do we have the long view down the aisle, but we have the church reoriented so that the long side is the side that has the pulpit, the focus. This was a conscious rejection of the processional character of the Catholic tradition, which leads us to at least think about what tends to be the prevalent approach of new church building where there were new churches. Unfortunately, most of these have long since disappeared. French and some Dutch examples of central plan churches by Reformed congregations. The central plan that was dreamed about by Renaissance architects seems to become normative. One interesting piece of evidence is that Martin Bucer, writing comments to his Anglican or his Puritan friends, explicitly says, in his opinion, that the circular church would be the best for the gathered church to come around the preached word. And it must have been the opinion of others. Of course, the idea of gathering seems to make some sense in a central plan church. These are ideas about the furnishings in several French and Dutch examples. And you can see, again, there's some kind of experimentation going on, a variety of approaches. We know at the Lyon Temple that I showed you before, that was a circular building. Of course, there still is some orientation, right? There's still a focus, and so there is a kind of directionality. But primarily for us, there's a gathering around the pulpit, the means of grace. And above, there's a gallery, another feature that became popular with the Reformers and was not popular, even though the Byzantine church had it. It was not typical to find a gallery space, a balcony, in a pre-Reformation Western church. An even larger church temple, as they called it, was built at Rouen, now long gone. It was a wooden and half-timbered construction, and then filled, absolutely filled with seating, with no central aisle, no way to walk down the aisle for a wedding, but this focus on gathering around the preached word, which has a special set-off zone for it and a very elaborate pulpit, we imagine. The Charenton church that I showed you before is similar. It's not central planned. It's a basilica, but the emphasis was on gathering as many people as possible, now in a double gallery, with the pulpit, as far as we know, placed about a quarter of the way down on one side, so that we still have this sense of being gathered around the room. I haven't said much, and I've skipped over this, about the celebration of the Lord's Supper. In many cases, although what Terry said is true, in many cases the Lord's Supper was celebrated at different intervals, depending on which tradition you're following, by bringing in tables for that celebration. And so furniture would be moved and put in place when necessary. So you wouldn't have the fixed view necessarily of the table that we have today. And in fact, I don't think our table was there in the earlier part of the century either. And the same is true of the baptismal font, which often was a bowl that was brought in, sometimes carried on a bracket, as it would be in New England churches, as part of the pulpit furniture. But it would be done in the front. In other cases, we know that the congregation would actually get up and move to go to the tables, which in some of the big churches where they decided to meet in the nave, they would then go to the chancel, which would be set up with tables, or vice versa, have the preaching in the chancel and have the tables in the other parts so that they could progress to go to the table. Show you a few pictures of Reformation era churches. This one's a little bit phony because it's a reconstructed church with a few changes to it that has been set up at a open air history museum in the Netherlands in Arnhem. And in it we see a very small rectangular box with these are later chairs that have been added, a pulpit that is raised with fixed seating. This also is late 19th century, so it's not part of the original. With a soundboard and then with scripture on the walls. I have neglected to mention that it was quite common that that verses rather than images would be placed there, and most commonly, of course, the Decalogue would appear throughout several of the Reformed traditions on the wall, so that that one could be reminded of God's law and then of His grace. Here's a church in Switzerland, similar kind of arrangement. In this case, you can see that there is the fixed table, and the pulpit has moved off to the side. So the emphasis now is on the table, but it's explicitly a table and not an altar. Now, that brings me back to the church I told you I was so intrigued with, the Church of St. Paul's Covent Garden, which was explicitly a Puritan chapel done by one of the greatest architects of all time, in my opinion, in a prominent place, with a little more money spent than most Puritan churches that we know. Unfortunately, as I said yesterday, I can't show you I could show you the interior, but what's there now is not what was there before. We know that it had galleries. We know that it had a central pulpit and it had the Decalogue. But the reason I want to show it to you tonight is because it gets at what we're going to talk about tomorrow. There's a connection here between worship and urbanism. This church was reformed in every way, but it was completed after the ascension of Archbishop Laud, the reason why so many of the Puritans left England. And Laud, of course, to the chagrin of and consternation even more to many of the Puritans, reinstituted several practices that they had had abolished. One of them was orientation, something that we haven't talked about yet. Churches were very early in church history. There's a debate as to when this begins. Were oriented so that the prayers were said facing the east. There is a connection here with non-Christian religions where facing the east was done in Hellenistic traditions. But of course, this was to associate with Christ and the resurrection. And there are several passages of early church fathers that refer to why we pray to the east. That meant that churches were often, but by no means always, oriented. The very word, I could just stop there and say they were oriented. Right? They faced the east. That's what that word means. They were oriented so that the apse was in the east and the entry would be in the west. To this day, we learn in art history that the west end is the one with the facade, even though it's not always true. And of course, the Constantinian basilicas were quite the opposite of that. They had their front doors facing the east, and there's debate as to why that was. And if you go to Rome, churches really face every direction you can think of. But there is this practice of orienting churches, and Archbishop Laud thought that this was very important. Well, it might have been important, but there was a problem. St. Paul's was placed at the end of a piazza, as he called it, an open square, and it needed to face onto the square, which it does. But in order to conform, which they were willing to do, I suppose not to be thrown into the tower, what Inigo Jones did is he built a fake door, and the real entrance, here's the Covent Garden, which becomes this great marketplace, as many of you know. He built a church, so that's a fake front door. The pulpit would have been there. This presumably would be, I'm sorry, this is a fake door. The pulpit would be here. This is the gallery, and this is the real entrance, which you can see you've got to go through the churchyard to get to. I admire Jones for doing this, and also for insisting that it still have a portico to engage the public, to be a witness, as well as to serve the purposes of the church. But it is a kind of compromise. Well, all right, there's just some comments, some illustrations of things that we've looked at in the Reformation. It's worth commenting, too, though, that the Catholic Church had its Reformation. For many, it's popular not to say counter-Reformation, but to say the Catholic Reformation. And they did have one. That is, there are reforms that come through Trent and even before Trent. And these have a direct impact on the architecture. As we said, the screens come down in the Reformation. We know that that in the councils of Trent, the use of art becomes very important. By let me read to you from the documents. By means of stories and mysteries of our redemption, portrayed by many paintings and other representations, the people will be instructed and confirmed in the habit of remembering and continually revolving in their mind articles of faith. There's a call for more decoration, more ornamentation, and explicitly to convince a kind of rhetoric or propaganda, a propagandistic role for art, not that it never had that before. And one of the chief goals here was to emphasize the altar, visually. So making that visual access apparent was now important, as it had, the opposite had been true before, kind of hiding it. So what we find in the late Renaissance and in the Baroque era are some of the most spectacular altars that we know. We also have a kind of sobriety. It's funny. We have this initial sobriety, openness, and clarity, and auditory spaces in which preaching can take place, is another of the points made by Trent and also by the great Charles Borromeo, a very pious and reforming bishop and then archbishop from Milan, who actually wrote a book on architecture, on the instructions on how to build churches. And he was very knowledgeable about architecture. And he tells us in his book on the instructions of how to build buildings that the churches should be plain and simple and should be built for the spoken word. They should be cruciform. They should not be centralized. If you follow Borromeo and you follow Trent, you get some rather wonderful churches, such as Palladio's Venice Churches of San Giorgio, with the temple fronts and interiors like this, that of course draw on the Renaissance tradition. They're elegant. They're simple might be not quite the right word, but they are fairly austere, not highly decorated, except at the apse end. And you'll notice that the choir has moved to the very back. This is a monastic church, so they don't interrupt our view anymore. We see them through a screen, a very elegant screen, and it all seems much more connected to the people, which is part of the point of Trent. Similar thing happens at St. Peter's, which I showed, right? The view becomes very important. Our view down the axis, where we see the crossing, which is now the location where Peter is. The church, he didn't move, the church shifted. And he's now covered by this great baldacchino I showed you before. And behind that, which is now like a couple city blocks away from you as you enter, is the Cathedra Petri, above the high altar against the back apse. That's the chair of St. Peter lifted up into the heavens by the early Christian fathers, explicitly denying what the reformers were saying about the early Christian fathers and the importance of Peter. This church was meant to convince you, if you were a German Lutheran coming down to Rome wondering whether you should embrace the Reformation or not, when you come out of this church, the visual rhetoric was emphatic that you would be convinced of the truth of the one true Catholic Church because of the spectacle that you see. Here are some examples of Baroque altars, and the spectacle becomes increasingly spectacular. At the private chapel, Cornaro Chapel, of course, is almost like opera. And German Baroque churches, such as the Pilgrimage Church of the 14 Heiligen, becomes this amazing, this cacophonous display of statuary, color, and space. We already noticed that that the Baroque tendencies, the visual spectacle, can be seen at St. Paul's. And as I did before, I'm going to skip over St. Paul's, though, to go to Christopher Wren, who is I think, a kind of a hero. Despite his background, Wren's uncle was an archbishop who was imprisoned under the, during the Civil War. He was very much a high church man. He was a restoration architect by every account. But when he rebuilt the churches of London, he built them in ways that emphasized the spoken word. Auditory chambers, he referred to them, that engaged the public. And we can't see them the way that they were. Some people have begun to do reconstructions, such as St. James Piccadilly. This seems to be the arrangement of that church initially, which included the altar against the wall. This follows the what we would expect in the Restoration era, with an altar railing around it, which comes, this, by the way, was Laud's innovation, the fact that you would have an altar rail at all. So that's typical, but there is a pulpit right there in the center. In fact, it's a triple decker with reader desks underneath the pulpit, which is common in Puritan churches. You would mistake this as a Puritan church, except when you saw the altar on the back wall. But, of course, that changed, and if you go there today, it has a split chancel with the pulpit and a lectern on one side, and the visual axis is now toward the altar. But the well, it's covered up, yeah. I believe that the Decalogue is still behind that those curtains. Similarly, we see St. Stephen's Walbrook, which I showed yesterday, a fairly austere classical building. The pulpit, in this case, off to one side, but embracing the centralized plan ideal that the reformers had toyed with in the 16th century. We know in a couple of Wren churches that there was actually a rood screen. The rood screen in the Restoration was sometimes reintroduced, but it never was the barrier that it was before. It was quite open, kind of open work. No longer would it carry a cross, it would carry the coat of arms of the monarch above, which is the English tradition. Same sort of thing you can see in Hawksmoor's church, it's in Christchurch Spitalfield that we looked at yesterday, generally the same ideas. And, of course, in the Puritan churches in New England, we have a much more austere, a plain style that's been alluded to before. Unfortunately, as I said, the 17th century churches are almost inaccessible to us as objects because they've been modified or destroyed altogether, except for the Hingham Church, the Hingham Meeting House, I should say, which you saw yesterday, very simple, very utilitarian, filled with box seats which gather around the central pulpit with reading desks down here. The baptismal font would be a bowl that would be brought in, and I don't actually know how the Lord's Supper was served, and maybe some of you know that. We can talk about it later. Here's another meeting house from the 18th century, even additions made later than that, which has the same sensibility, a little bit more refined, strong emphasis on the pulpit as we see at IPC, and we see this this developing, as you can see in the Old South Church, quite famous for other reasons, where the pulpit becomes the focus. Or even in the Baptist tradition, the First Baptist Church, this is the First Baptist Church. Right, the first one in America, in Providence, from the later 18th century. It's hardly distinguishable from a Presbyterian church. Here's a familiar one, which carries that same tradition that that Terry eloquently spoke to us about, so I hardly need to elaborate on it. I did show to some earlier, this photograph is actually of the real thing, the church that was finished in 1819 that burned down in 1889, almost identical, of course, it was meant to be. And I don't, I can't tell in this picture whether there's a hanging down here, perhaps. There might be a table, but I'm not certain about that. Now, we look today at churches representing the Gothic Revival, and, of course, the liturgically, the influence of the ecclesiological movement, the Oxford movement, as it's also known. And I showed you Trinity Church, and here's an interior, a couple of interior views of Trinity Church, where the idea of looking down the aisle at the altar becomes once again important, where a separation and a raising of the sanctuary becomes important, and where an altarpiece, a reredos, or a retable, or a large altarpiece, is placed, is reintroduced from the Middle Ages in order to create a sense of the sacrament that had been lost. And this meant that the split chancel that had been developing, but developed definitively in the 19th century as we know it, really hadn't been fully used, the idea of the splitting between the lectern and the pulpit, really before the ecclesiological movement. Here's a more strict example, actually following Pugin's dictums from England, where we have a church with fixed seating, a central aisle, a raised chancel, altar in the back. We have pulpit and lectern, and we have the reintroduction of seating on the side that reminds us of the choir. And the same sort of sensibility in Ralph Adams Cram's St. Thomas Church in New York that I showed before, with the most amazing reredos in the United States, probably, in this really superb church of its kind. Now, that tradition, as we said, is one tradition. As Terry mentioned, you could follow that line, and that goes down to the present day. In, I guess in America, we'll call it the high church side. But in the lower church side, where we follow the Second Great Awakening and the revival movements throughout the 19th century, we do have a new typology. But is it a new typology? It, as we suggested last time, is perhaps a development that comes from the meeting house. Utilitarian large halls that can hold many people gathered to hear the preached word. But the difference is that they do build, as here at the Broadway Tabernacle, this is Finney's church in New York, his tabernacle. We have a more or less circular church with a raised platform. We have a large organ. We have a choir in the back, and a spectacle like a theater, or as Terry referred to it at Moody, Moody's church. Now, this is the church built to commemorate Moody after his death. But you can go there today at Moody Memorial Church and see a partially circular building with a door on the side, wraparound gallery, all focused on an enormous choir platform area that becomes the normative formula for many church traditions throughout the 19th century, when church becomes theater, as a recent art historian has labeled her book that discusses this development in American architecture, church architecture. And of course, that's the tradition that is linked to the contemporary evangelical church, to the megachurch tradition, such as we've already noted and we've shown these slides. And it's a direct line from the revivalism of the 19th century to these large boxes with sloped seating. But you'll have to say that there are connections, formalistic connections, between what's happening here and what happened with the 16th century reformers at the Lyon Temple, for example. Except they didn't do this, I don't think, at the Lyon Temple, which has now become the norm, right? The transformation of this shape into something that really is a place for spectacle. As we mentioned yesterday, it seems a bit ironic because this is returning to the very kind, a different kind of spectacle, but the idea of spectacle and procession and ritual and image were the cause for the reformers to want to change. That's what they were moving away from. So now that tradition is reinvested with new forms of imagery and ritual. We showed this comparison before. And we alluded also to the modernist version of the high church movement, which sought to spiritualize, to do things that the ecclesiological society would probably be rather upset with, but still in the spirit of creating a spiritual space. Here's the floor plan for the Notre Dame du Haut at Longchamp by Le Corbusier, which is an almost freeform-like plan, having an interior altar and table, looking quite plain and austere, actually, and also an exterior pulpit and an altar for outside services. And we showed these, too. This fascination with austerity and purity is another ironic twist, I think, with some of the modernist high church traditions, which are drawing on the other side of the Puritan tradition, which is the plain style, the plain, simple, not distracting space. So, finally, I'm not going to give you answers, but I want to explore a little bit where this leaves us and where Reformed worship might turn to find an appropriate modern setting for worship. We do have some 20th century churches that take the principles of the Reformation seriously, and you can find these in the Brugink and Dropper's book on Christ and Architecture, which is really an excellent source that Terry was referring to. The authors there are very committed Dutch Reformed Christians who are seeking a way to make word, sacraments, and prayer represented in the church and actually make the church functional and not distracting in the manner that Karl Barth had spoken of. So I just put up a few examples of 20th century churches. I don't know the date. This is in their book, but this is a 20th century church which is drawing on historical traditions in Holland. It has these interesting lattice windows. It's basically a box. It has a raised pulpit. There's no central aisle. It's a sounding board, even. And it has a table in the front, and there's a font off to the side right here, so the same kind of arrangement that we have at ICC, or a more interesting or unusual attempt at the same thing would be at this church, a suburb of Amsterdam. I couldn't find the best pictures. Here's the model of the church. 1959, 50-year-old church now, using the same imagery as Corbusier, or that same lexicon, we might say, the curvilinear unusual forms, and having even curvilinear ceilings, fixed seating, a fixed concrete font, a pulpit in a simple modern style, and it's off the screen here, but you can see a very simple table. The pulpit, of course, as in the Swiss church that we saw, it's now off to the side, the table is there, but the importance of word, sacraments, and prayer, and of simple, non-distracted worship is very clear and emphatic, if the concrete and unusual surfaces are to your satisfaction. Here's another example. I tried to look this up on the internet to see if this church exists. I couldn't find it, so I suspect it doesn't. Maybe somebody knows. Here we have a church in Cleveland, Ohio, that was actually worked on by Lydroppers and Bridging, both as consultants. It's an A-frame church, actually. Very simple. It has a central aisle. The pulpit is slightly off to one side. The table, set with chairs and with a plate and a cup and a beaker, and the font here as a rough cut stone on the side, very strongly proclaim what the church is about. I was thinking about what are the best examples that I could come up with. Those are very strong examples, but I still think that maybe I agree with Terry on the prejudice, perhaps, but not just IPC, but there are some other churches. Really give a very vivid picture of what Reformed theology and Reformed worship is about. Now, let's just think, to wrap this up, think about where we could go, and I'll give you some food for thought for a discussion tomorrow, all right? Worship according to Scripture, we're told, I learned, can be thought of as having three parts, right? There are the elements of Christian worship, the word, sacraments, and prayer. Congregational singing is an important part of that as well, singing the word as well as preaching and reading the word. Well, what does architecture have to do with that, right? Architecture serves those purposes, but it's not a direct relationship with architecture. There are forms, right? There are elements, and then there are forms. There are the liturgies, the forms which the reading, preaching, and singing take, and these have to do with how the worship is done. It's not exactly architectural. And then we're told that there are circumstances. The circumstances are when you meet, and what the room is like, and what we're wearing, all those things which are circumstantial. So if we think about architecture, if I think about architecture, we have to say that architecture, in the scope of the setting of Christian worship, is fundamentally circumstantial. That's its role, to provide a good part of the circumstance for Christian worship. So how should that be done? Building on what I said earlier and what some of us have said, it seems to me it's quite simple and basic, right? In the Reformed tradition, the circumstances should not distract. They should be done in such a way that they're done with order and with dignity. So it seems to me that a Reformed architectural setting should be a dignified setting. And oh, I had them all here, right? and that, of course, seems to fit with what we talked about earlier, that it should be decorous. It should be appropriate. All the parts should fit together harmoniously in a way that does not distract, but complements, adorns, as Dr. Old had said, the worship that takes place. And finally, it should be, I think, delightful. It's kind of a curious word. I'm taking the word delightful from a 17th century English writer on architecture who said, and I could have said these three things, architecture should be done with firmness, commodity, and delight. Those words have actually come from an ancient Roman writer called Vitruvius. sums it up, right? What kind of architecture is good architecture? It's architecture that is firm, commodious, it works, and it is delightful. The actual word venustas, could also be translated beauty, beautiful. I think delightful is right. And here Dr. Roll's point about architecture being an adornment, being done with excellence, something that we can rejoice in but not be distracted by, which points us to greater truths, points us to a beauty and a glory which is far beyond the material. That's the answer. That still doesn't tell you how to build a church, though. So I thought about a way to conclude this by showing you an example of a recently made church that I think is dignified, decorous, and delightful, that supports words, sacraments, and prayer, and is a good building. I couldn't think of one. I think that architecture right now is, there's some fabulous things, some really spectacular buildings being done by some famous and less famous architects out there. And I also think that there's a strong contingent of very serious-minded traditional architects. The ones I admire most today, in case you're interested in what my own opinion is here, they're mostly Catholics. There's a very strong liturgical renewal movement, rather conservative and very admirable in many ways, the center of which can be found in South Bend, Indiana, at the Notre Dame School of Architecture, the only school in the United States that teaches the classical tradition through and through. Very serious, smart people thinking about restoring architecture, and especially church architecture, to make it dignified, decorous, and delightful, but papist, and filled with images and other things I wouldn't abide. I did think, though, of one building I've seen recently that I find very admirable. It's not a Reformed church. In fact, it's an ecumenical chapel.